This is Andre Traverso with the Cosmic Citizen, and I have the last-minute glitches I had to take care of again, kind of like I did last week. But again, as I said, this is live radio. This is what it's all about. With me is my lovely co-host, Paula Thompson. Paula, how are you doing this morning?
I'm well, Andre. Doing
good.
Great.
Good. I am, too. I'm glad you and I are well, because unfortunately there are some people who probably aren't well. Notably, the victims of Hurricane Ike. And I hope that even though there are a lot of victims of that hurricane, I hope they are well, even if their belongings have been damaged. And I really would like us to start out the show with a little bit of prayer time for them. Would you lead us in a prayer for the people who are trapped in that terrible disaster there in on the coast of Texas?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Let's just take a moment. Think about all of the people in Haiti and Cuba and now in Houston that have been affected by this storm, and say, Heavenly Father, Father of hosts, in the center of all things, send your angels of peace and comfort to the people that are suffering right now because of this storm. We understand that the world and the weather and things that happen on this world just happen, because it's life in a material world, and these are the vicissitudes of life, Father. We understand this. And it's at times like these that folks who are involved in these disasters need your help and your comfort more than ever before. So we humbly ask, Father, that you send your angels and your comfort to these people in greater measure than ever. And Christ Michael, Master Jesus, we ask that you give them your peace, the peace that passes understanding. And we know and we have faith that all things work together for good. And we know that when things crumble, oftentimes they are rebuilt better than they were before. So this is what we ask, is for your peace and your comfort. Even so, may it be. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Paula. Thank you. And I just echo that prayer, and I just thank you that prayer is being broadcast to the listeners here, and I wholeheartedly know that they're standing in agreement with us. Before we introduce our guest, I would like to introduce the subject matter by reading a couple of quotes from the Urantia book. And these are kind of long passages, but they're worth reading because they really introduce our subject in a really clear and specific way from the book itself. I'm going to read the first one, which is the acknowledgement at the end of the foreword for those of you who have... I don't know what editions you all have. For those of you who have the Foundation edition, it is on page 16, and it begins this way. In formulating the succeeding presentations having to do with the portrayal of the character of the Universal Father and the nature of his paradise associates, together with an attempted description of the perfect central universe and the encircling seven superuniverses, we are to be guided by the mandate of the superuniverse rulers, which directs that we shall, in all our efforts to reveal truth and coordinate essential knowledge, give preference to the highest existing human concepts pertaining to the subjects to be presented. We may resort to pure revelation only when the concept of presentation has had no adequate previous expression by the human mind. Successive planetary revelations of divine truth invariably embrace the highest existing concept of spiritual values as a part of the new and enhanced coordination of planetary knowledge. Accordingly, in making these presentations about God and his universe associates, we have selected as the basis of these papers more than 1,000 human concepts representing the highest and most advanced planetary knowledge of spiritual values and universe meanings. Wherein these human concepts, assembled from the God-knowing mortals of the past and the present, are inadequate to portray the truth as we are directed to reveal it, we will unhesitatingly supplement them, for this purpose, drawing upon our own superior knowledge of the reality and divinity of the paradise deities and their transcendent residential universe. We are fully cognizant of the difficulties of our assignment. We recognize the impossibility of fully translating the language of the concepts of divinity and eternity into the symbols of the language of the finite concepts of the mortal mind. But we know that there dwells within the human mind a fragment of God, and that there sojourns with the human soul the spirit of truth, And we further know that these spirit forces conspire to enable material man to grasp the reality of spiritual values and to comprehend the philosophy of universe meanings. But even more certainly, we know that these spirits of the divine presence are able to assist man in the spiritual appropriation of all truth contributory to the enhancement of the ever-progressing reality of personal religious experience, God consciousness. Paula, would you like to read our next acknowledgement? The next acknowledgement comes from Part 4, and it's the Midwayer's acknowledgement at the beginning of the life and teachings of Jesus. I would love for you to read that for us, if you would.
Okay, and just a little background. Midwayers are creatures that are midway between men and angels. This Midwayer in particular is a secondary Midwayer, most likely, that has been here on the planet with us for many, many, many thousands of years. They do not get to ascend in the universe until our planet reaches light and life. So they are particularly interested in our ascension and our progression, and they are particularly knowledgeable about who we are and what we might need to know. And so with that in mind, here is the Midwayer's acknowledgement. Acknowledgement. In carrying out my commission to restate the teachings and retell the doings of Jesus of Nazareth, I have drawn freely from all sources of record and planetary information. My ruling motive has been to prepare a record which will not only be enlightening to the generation of men now living, but which may also be helpful to all future generations. From the vast store of information made available to me, I have chosen that which is best suited to the accomplishment of this purpose. As far as possible, I have derived my information from purely human sources. Only when such sources failed have I resorted to those records which are superhuman. When ideas and concepts of Jesus' life and teachings have been acceptably expressed by a human mind, I invariably gave preference to such apparently human thought patterns. Although I have sought to adjust the verbal expression to conform to our concept of the real meaning and true import of the Master's life and teachings, as far as possible, I have adhered to the actual human concept and thought pattern in all my narratives. I well know that those concepts which have had origin in the human mind will prove more acceptable and helpful to all other human minds. When unable to find the necessary concepts in the human records or in human expressions, I have next resorted to the memory resources of my own order of earth creatures, the Midwayers. And when that secondary source of information proved inadequate, I have unhesitatingly resorted to the superhuman, superplanetary sources of information. The memoranda which I have collected and from which I have prepared this narrative of the life and teachings of Jesus, aside from the memory of the record of the Apostle Andrew, embrace thought gems and superior concepts of Jesus' teachings assembled from more than 2,000 human beings who have lived on earth from the days of Jesus down to the time of the inditing of these revelations, more correctly, restatements. The revelatory permission has been utilized only when the human record and human concepts failed to supply an adequate thought pattern. My revelatory commission forbade me to resort to extra human sources of either information or expression until such time as I could testify that I had failed in my efforts to find the required conceptual expression in purely human sources. While I, with the collaboration of my 11 associate fellow Midwayers, and under the supervision of the Melchizedek of record, have portrayed this narrative in accordance with the concept of its highest effective arrangement, and in response to my choice of immediate expression, nevertheless, the majority of the ideas and even some of the effective expressions which I have thus utilized had their origin in the minds of men of many races who have lived on earth during the intervening generations, right on down to those who are still alive at the time of this undertaking. In many ways, I have served more as a collector, an editor, than as an original narrator. I have unhesitatingly appropriated those ideas and concepts, preferably human, which would enable me to create the most effective portraiture of Jesus' life, and which would qualify me to restate his matchless teachings in the most strikingly helpful and universally uplifting phraseology. In behalf of the Brotherhood of the United Midwares of Urantia, I most gratefully acknowledge our indebtedness to all sources of record and concept which have been hereinafter utilized in the further elaboration of our restatement of the life and teachings of Jesus.
Wow. Well, you know, normally in talk radio, it's not good practice to read long passages like that on the air, but we did that this time, folks, because of the topic we're about to present, which is the fact that the Urantia book, even though it claims to be a revelation, which we believe it is, honestly admit, not only does it use human sources in the book, it quotes directly from human sources, borrows freely from human sources, but it admits to doing so. They don't hide it at all. They don't attempt to conceal it. And so I just want people to know that the book itself acknowledges this. And in two places, at least, in the place that Paula just read, even more so. And in order to just here to discuss with us this very, I believe, really fascinating topic, and you'll see why it's fascinating as we go on, to the human source material that was used in the Urantia book is Steve Dreyer. Steve Dreyer is a retired high school chemistry teacher. He's past president of the Urantia Book Fellowship. He is now secretary, I think, of the fellowship, and he is just has been reading the book since the 1970s, at least. And has quite an extensive acquaintance with the text. And with us on the air on the Cosmic Citizen, Steve Dreyer. Steve, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Andre.
You're welcome. And by the way, I just want to make sure people know that you are free to call in here, 646-716-8158, 646-716-8158. I want to reiterate something, Steve, and just have you comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
I said just a minute ago that not only do the authors use human sources, but they admit it. They're not trying to hide this from us. You know, I think some readers may feel like, gee, you know, I feel betrayed now that I found out these human sources are there. But they don't make any attempt to conceal this, do they?
No, I don't believe that anybody who's studied the situation and understands what these sources are would feel that attempts have been made to conceal those relationships. I'd suggest the reverse is true. One of the reasons that they're relatively easy to find is that no attempt has been made to conceal them.
Okay. Let me ask you another question, Steve. They sort of explain this just a little bit, but again, I'd like your elaboration on this. Why do you think they chose to use human sources? Why didn't they just use pure revelation alone?
Well, I think you've covered that in the passages that you read. The argument used is that since this is a revelation for human beings, the greatest likelihood of these human beings understanding what's being communicated to them is likely to take place through the use of thoughts, ideas, concepts that have already been expressed by human beings. Right? The argument being that if human beings have already given expression to these things, there's a good chance that they understand them at least somewhat. Whereas, you know, if you present people with human beings with totally new ideas that have never appeared in a human mind, there's a much lower chance that they'll understand what's being communicated.
Okay. Now, you've done a lot of research on this, Steve. You along with Matthew Block, you've read a lot of these source books. You've looked at the quotes that were used. Before I get into the specific human sources and how they were used, I want to ask you another question. And this could actually, this alone could probably be worthy of a whole other show, but I'd like to talk about it a little bit. You know, in paper 120 in the book, The Times of Michael Bestole, we get a whole outline of the various philosophies and the various religious trends that were going on at the time that Michael came. And I think they say in the book that this was like a really fertile time spiritually. and it was that the Urantia was going through a kind of spiritual renaissance at that time, and it was just the soil was just ready to receive Michael's teachings. Do you think that the same thing could have been said maybe of the 1920s and 1930s? Do you think that intellectually, philosophically, theologically, do you think there were trends that the revelators wanted to build on? Do you think there were things that, do you think there was a fertile soil going on there, in academia and in the popular culture that could have been used, that you think was used to that the revelators built on? In other words, to get across what they were trying to get across.
Well, I'm not sure I would put it that way. My sense is that the period of time around the turn of the century, from the 1800s into the 1900s, early part of the 1900s, was a period of very rapid change in life and in thought, and I suspect that the Urantia book, to some extent, plays a role of conservation of thought, which might otherwise have been lost.
Well, okay, give me an example.
It doesn't only do that, but that's one of the things that it does. Well, during this period, suppose we go back a little to give you a feeling for what was taking place.
Okay.
In the 1800s, around 1830, right, let's start there. I mean, we could start earlier, but we don't need to extend this unnecessarily. The first critical analysis of the Gospels was published by a man named David Strauss. Right? It was a seminal work. It wasn't possible to do this before, because before that time you would have risked your life to do what Strauss did. But it was essentially a critical and very skeptical analysis of the Gospels.
Mm.
And it had a widespread influence and a widespread effect. Strauss was, as you might expect, duly condemned, found it difficult to get work.
Now, do you think he would consider? Do you think Strauss considered himself a Christian?
No,
okay.
No. Strauss was a skeptic. I don't think you could consider Strauss a believer particularly.
Okay.
But the point I'm making is that it was around that time that you could first do this kind of thing, right? You could first raise questions, and the questions were questions like, is the content of the Bible valid? Right? Can we assume that it's factual, it's believable? Right? And in particular, can we assume that the content of the Gospels, right, particularly the Synoptic Gospels, is valid? So Strauss wrote a rather large work. It's still available. People still read it.
Steve, was Strauss American?
No, he was European. He was, either German or Austrian, I guess.
Okay.
David Friedrich Strauss was his name. So this now sets in motion this sort of thing, a lot of skeptical writings. You know, once you open the gates to these things and people feel free to study and express their thinking without danger of getting killed, they do, right? The stuff is the work is done and it's published and it's discussed and so forth, right? And this takes place all through the 1800s, and of course continues to take place even till today, right? This sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to let you go on, but I want to just interject the thing.
Yeah.
Not only was there a lot of skeptical writing and criticism, I think that's known today as higher criticism of the Bible. But even some of that higher criticism was even being used by, there was a renaissance in liberal Protestant thought as well. Liberal Protestant theology was kind of in its heyday at that time. you know, starting in the, I guess you could say starting in the 1800s and going into the 1900s. But they did not reject the whole Bible. They were using, you know, they were using Jesus to kind of as a lens to understand the Bible. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the phrase the Urantia Book uses, the Gospel about Jesus versus the Gospel of Jesus, that's not unique to the Urantia Book. I think that was a pretty popular slogan among liberal Protestant circles in the early 20th century, late 19th century.
Yes, that theme developed during that period of time. You know, although it really flowered a bit later, it was the question of the religion of Jesus and the religion about Jesus, right? The distinction between those two. But just to continue this background into the source materials. If you move through the 1800s, you know, you've got the Industrial Revolution is really picking up steam. In addition to this, science is starting to develop its role, right, which continues to this day. But that also is picking up steam. All sorts of interesting discoveries are being made in chemistry. You know, you've got, for example, Pasteur, right? In the, I guess around the 1880s or so, founding microbiology, right? So beginning to put to rest the idea that disease is caused by evil spirits that have gotten inside you. And developing the scientific basis for microbiology, the nature of the atom, right, starts to become a bit clearer in the late 1800s. Einstein publishes in 1905 his seminal papers, and then from that period through the 1920s, the field of quantum mechanics is developed. It's a time of enormous change, right? Plus, during this period, we have the telegraph developed, right? Electricity is now being distributed. Automobiles. It's a phenomenal period.
And of course, we also have the discovery of evolution. Not only the discovery of evolution.
Oh, right. I should have mentioned Darwin.
Not only the discovery of evolution, but the application of evolution as a concept, as a philosophical concept.
Right.
It was being applied in sociology, in anthropology, and even in theology, because there was this, you know, we know from the Urantia Book talks about how the concept of God in the Old Testament grows and develops as you go through the scripture. Well, that was something, again, that was identified by Christian writers at that time as well.
You know what I like to, and the way I like to describe it to people, just in terms of, Steve, you pointed out the amazing growth and changes and acceleration in human thought and science, obviously, at that time. And I often tell people, look, my grandmother was born in 1893. She crossed the prairie in a covered wagon, and yet in her one life, she lived to see men walk on the moon. That's astonishing to think about, because for hundreds of thousands of years, men got around on foot or by horse. And then in one life, they went from crossing the prairie in a covered wagon to watch seeing men walk on the moon. So it was an astonishing period of change. Perhaps unprecedented, I don't know. But
Well, it was. There have been other periods that in which humanity's gone through lots of change, but this was the change that leads us into our time, our period. You know, so it's a change we can better appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been lots of change going on around Jesus' time too. You know, with the ascendancy and then decline of Rome.
What I really want to get into, though, is not so much the technological changes, as important as they are, but the intellectual roots or the foundations, I would say, of the revelation.
Okay, well, that was the point of this. This may be too lengthy this too lengthy lead-in. What happened here was that because there were all these great successes in the physical, right, in the world of physical reality, all these scientific successes in industrial techniques, in physics, in chemistry, in biology, right? People didn't need God as much. They didn't have to rely on God. They had science, right? They had their own ability to approach the problems of existence with their minds and solve them, right? That they had, and they began to rely more and more on that. And in addition to that, the freedom to critically analyze the arguments and the claims of religion, right, was present, and people applied the same techniques they were using in other fields to that subject. So lots of skepticism creeped in, right? And people, of course, listen, also along with this is obviously the study of history, right? And anthropology and archaeology, all of this is part of it. People began to look at a lot of religion as just superstition, ignorance. Right? And there was simply a decline of interest in theology, in religion in general, particularly amongst educated people. That's what was going on.
Okay, but if there was so much skepticism, how?
This is the situation that, as it exists in the early part of the 1900s, right? Remember, we're also going to have a couple of nightmarish wars coming right up, right, that are further going to cause discouragement and disillusionment about the presence of God in the world, even the existence of God.
Okay, but let me ask you, if there was so much skepticism, you're talking about the skepticism that was rampant.
Yeah.
If there was so much skepticism, how were the revelators able to find human sources? Because obviously they were using human sources. Not all of them, but a lot of the human sources they're using, the vast majority were from people who did believe in God.
That's correct.
So there must have still been some kind of spiritual, I won't say rebirth or renaissance, but some kind of spiritual, there must have been some ideas that were floating around that the revelators wanted to use that were high spiritual concepts.
Yes, that's correct. There certainly were.
Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, there were actually numerous individuals who remained believers, who simply had the experience of God in their lives, right? and who did not become skeptics. In fact, they moved off in the other direction. You know, they continued thinking and expressing their thoughts about God and God's relationship to individuals, to the cosmos.
Okay. Give me some examples.
So, now, if you want to know who, you want some specific examples?
Yeah, give me some specific examples of people, of authors. Give us some specific examples of authors of the Urantia book. Well, actually, before you can give it to authors, give me some examples of concepts that you think the revelators used that were concepts or ideas or trends that the revelators built on in the text of the Urantia book.
Well, they're numerous, of course. One would obviously be the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man.
Yes, that was a popular slogan.
We're all children of God, right? Mm-hmm. Every human being is a child of God. That theme is built on the divinity of Jesus, of Christ, is accepted and built on. Even the concept of a finite evolving God is present in the work of the source authors. That is what we in the Urantia book tend to we call the supreme being.
Okay. There was also I know a philosophical movement called Boston Personalism, which you mentioned before.
Right. There was a field of philosophy or a division of philosophy which is not well known and has never really had large numbers of devotees, which is known as personalism, and that there's a particular form of it which developed in the United States, mostly at Boston University, so it's known as Boston personalism. It begins with a man named Borden Parker Bone, who did his work back in the 1880s, 1890s, through that period into the 1900s. Bone is not a source author, but two of his students, right, are source authors.
Okay, and what are their names?
One is Albert Knutson, and another is Ralph Tyler Flewelling.
Okay, and by the way, I don't want to. This may be, you know, again, I don't want to bore the listeners here, but
yeah.
What I'm trying to get at here is, what I want people to understand is that the Revelators used not just a little concept here and there, but really specific concepts that were, again, that were alive and well at that time to make their points. Now, what was the thrust of personalism in Boston personalism? What was the basic gist of it?
Yeah, well, the basic position of personalism is that personality is the fundamental reality.
Okay.
All right. So.
That's going to be familiar. That's going to be a familiar tune to our listeners. Go ahead.
Yeah. So their argument would be: in the beginning was personality, right? That's the first reality, and everything else is a consequence. That by everything else is meant matter, mm-hmm. energy, right? Time, space, everything else. The reason they developed this, well, there were many reasons, but in any case, many other philosophic approaches begin with matter and energy, right, as fundamental, and time and space as fundamental, and personality comes later, right? It sort of emerges from matter, energy, time, and space. But but the personalists reversed it, right? And their argument is that reality takes origin in a person.
Right. So what's happening here is that the Revelators are not just, you know, giving us this concept, this emphasis on personality as a purely revealed concept out of thin air. They're building on something that already had origin in the human mind.
There's no question about that. In the Urantia book, when it gets characterized, if and when it becomes better known and people study it more carefully and begin to put it into this category or that category, philosophically, it's certain to be classified as a personalist document.
Ah,
right?
Okay.
A document in the tradition and expressing the themes of personalism. And this is all through the book. The personalist quality, right, is all through the Urantia book.
Okay. The other thing that was going on too at the time was, and Paula, please feel free to jump in here. I'm just trying to get certain. I want to make sure we cover certain material here. But the other thing that was going on at the time, Steve, was people were trying to write biographies of Jesus. Wasn't that like a big? That it was, there were people writing things like The Quest for the Historical Jesus. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that there were people that were actually trying to make sense of the Gospels and kind of use the Gospels to kind of write a kind of coherent chronological biography of Jesus. Isn't that one of the things that was a popular...
Yes, of course, sure. I mean, as I said before, the same techniques, the same methods that were being employed in the world of physical sciences were applied to social sciences as well, to the study of history, right? This question came up, right? Among, I mean, one of the big questions that came up was there really a historical Jesus? Is he a historical character or is he a myth? That was the question that was being debated.
Yes, and I also want to let listeners know one of the books that the authors use, that the Revelators use, is a book called The Religion of Jesus by a man named Walter Bundy, who was a biblical scholar. The book was written in 1929. I read a little bit of the book, and it was very interesting because in there he speculates that Joseph might have died when Jesus was 14, which is exactly what the Urantia book tells us. Now, some people might, again, this is a matter of faith to those of us who believe in the Urantia book, but some skeptics might say, see, the Urantia book just borrowed this speculation from human from human beings, who, and they figured, you know, and they just put it into the book. But of course, you know, as believers, we believe that what really happened was that the human beings got some of these things right, and the revelators just built on it. And of course, you know, there's no way to prove or disprove that. That's a matter of faith. But tell us, for example, in part four, in the acknowledgement that Paula read, we're told that, you know, they use human sources as far as possible, you know, as much as possible. And you told me, I think, a few days ago that part four is the most sourced part of the book. And let me ask you, weren't there books that were these attempts to write biographies of Jesus, weren't those books some of the books that were used in part four? Like, I think there was one called The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the Edersheim book. That's one of the earliest of the books, of the source books. That dates from the 1880s.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
The full range, date range, runs roughly from that point around, I forget exactly what the date was, in the 1880s, up to 1942.
Okay.
And
you know,
it comprises... Yeah, you know, it's hard to say what the total number is. Maybe between 100 and 200. I mean, you know, Matthew Block would have a better fix on the total number than I do, but I'd say it's somewhere in that range. 100 and 200 to 200 published works, right? Books, this is. We're talking about books. And so, you know, we're roughly talking about that number of authors. In some cases, more than one book by the same author is used. And these authors are all writing in English. The majority of them you would probably classify as academics. You know, they're in universities or theologic seminaries. Not all of them, but many of them. They're all primarily men. There is a woman or two here or there in the author list.
Really, I didn't know anything about the women.
No, primarily. Well, you know, there's a couple. White men, Protestant men. I mean, that's the characterization of the authors of these books. Some of them were quite well known in the fields in which they worked. They were true scholars, and were widely studied in that day. Although, you know, many of them are ignored now. Most of them are probably ignored now. And others were more popular writers, right, who wrote for a more popular audience.
Paula, you were going to say something.
Something you said earlier, that you thought that a lot of what they were trying to do was preserve some of the thinking of the time, and that's something I never thought of before, and it's certainly gives me pause. And my sense of the Midwares in the last maybe two or three papers of the Urantia book give some very strong admonitions about secular materialism, you know, godless science, and, you know, they kind of spell it out for us that now that we've finally overthrown the heavy-handed authoritarian religious, you know, state, now will we completely abandon the notion of God and fall into secular materialism, and how horribly detrimental that could be to our planet, to our civilization, what we've worked so hard to create these many thousands of years. And I get a total sense of an emergency, an urgency to their message. And a quote comes to mind for me from, it's not by the Midwares. Those last three papers are just full of admonitions that are amazing, and you just have to take them in. And I don't know if there's any source author credited with some of that or not, but... this is from paper 99, The Social Problems of Religion, and it's section 4, Transition Difficulties. It says, and I know a lot of Urantia book readers will remember this quote, it says, during the psychologically unsettled times of the 20th century, amid the economic upheavals, the moral cross currents, and the sociologic riptides of the cyclonic transitions of a scientific era, thousands upon thousands of men and women have become humanly dislocated. They are anxious, restless, fearful, uncertain, and unsettled. As never before in the world's history, they need the consolation and stabilization of sound religion. In the face of unprecedented scientific achievement and mechanical development, there is spiritual stagnation and philosophic chaos. And if I could put into a nutshell the mission of the Arantia book,
yeah,
I think that's it. I think that, you know, in what you were saying about this skepticism and this science and you know, this just this tidal wave, it opened the floodgates in a sense. And then, you know, the spiritually minded men and women of that day responded with kind of the best they had to counter this tidal wave of skepticism about God and spiritual matters. And I think, you know, I get this sense that there's an urgency to the Arantia book in its, you know, to correct some of this imbalance that exists. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, yes. I mean, I think, as I said before, I think, at least to a certain extent, the book represents an effort at the conservation of ideas and concepts that were present, but in danger of being swamped by all the other things that were going on. You know, when I say in danger of being swamped, these ideas are generally stored in written works, and written works of this kind are generally produced by academicians, people who have posts in universities or theological seminaries, things of that sort. Right? But if the work that you are doing is not popular in the field, right, you don't get a post.
Right.
You don't get hired.
That's right. It's hard to get tenure and all that. Yeah.
That's correct. And if that's the case, you know, your work doesn't get widespread distribution. So this was a tough road for some of these folks to take, because the work that they were doing was not popular.
Let me interject there, Steve. Because you know what? Not only was it not popular then, it's even less popular today. I mean, the things that some of these people were saying today, it's really interesting because, you know, we get it as Euanthropic readers, we get it from both sides. We get it from fundamentalist Christians who don't like the book. We also get it from, you know, atheists and materialists and postmodern relativists who would not stand the book because, you know, to them the book is politically incorrect. How dare you say that one culture is superior to another? How dare you say that, you know, that progress, you know, happens in an orderly direction and some things are better than others? You know, we've degenerated so much intellectually since that time. There seemed to be, I get the sense of that time that among the authors that they were using, a lot of the authors, there was a really interesting thing that was going on. There was a kind of, there was an attempt to try to be neither, to try to harmonize science with religion, first of all. The best of the liberal Protestants were doing that. They weren't rejecting the Bible out of hand. They were saying, look, Jesus is our guy. We're going to view the Bible through the lens of Jesus. And they still accepted modern science and embraced modern science. You know, so basically, the Arantia book, I think, is an attempt to try to, by harmonizing science and religion, by conserving some of the best of that thought, what it's trying to do is say, look, you need to avoid one of two mistakes. Either you need to avoid just going back, resting on the security of just being, you know, fundamentalist religionists and going back to your old texts and just resting. You also need to avoid becoming, dogmatic scientific materialists or postmodern relativists. It seems to me like, you know, the Arantia book is really trying to walk a really fine line by harmonizing the best of science and the best of religion.
And the best of philosophy.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd agree with that, and that's part of the charm and mastery of the Arantia book, and the reason why it has such an impact with those with whom it has an impact. And that's what we respond to. We respond to this to the gestalt of the Urantia book. It's not any one thing particularly. It's the whole vision that the book presents from beginning to end. Right? That's the revelation that's in the book.
That's right.
Not any specific piece of information. Right? It leaves you, if you grasp it and if you respond to it, with a sense of the whole.
Right? Mm.
And when you consider any specific element, you consider that in the context of your sense of the whole. That's the revelation.
Right? Before you started doing this research, and before Matthew, especially, who was the first who really took this up in earnest, started doing this research, I think a lot of Urantia books, and I know including myself, had some preconceived notion about what human sources meant, about what those two sections that we read at the beginning of the show, the one at the beginning of the book, the one pretty much at the beginning of part four. We had a preconceived notion maybe of what that meant. And in light of the sources, all of that has changed. And I know that that has been disquieting for quite a few Urantia book readers. And I remember specifically when you took this up, you said, and I personally was so grateful to you for doing it, you said, we can't let, you know, Matthew be the only one who is doing this. I mean, we have to, you know, in order to create balance, we have to have more than one person that's also looking into these source authors. So you took it upon yourself to do that. And I know that, you know, I know Matthew has been stunned by some of the things he's found, and it shocked him. Did you find that that was true in your case? Did it shock you, some of the nature of the pervasive use of secondary or of source authors?
I suppose you could use that term. I mean, it wasn't what I expected, that's for sure. I didn't expect sources to mean published works from a relatively narrow time period. That's not what I was expecting. I didn't expect it to be as easy to identify a source as it is. Right? I mean, it's easy because the relationship is so obvious, right, and so statistically undeniable. So those are things I'd have to say I didn't expect that.
So what's been your?
By the way, Paula, just to answer your question, you know that passage that you read is sourced, right?
Ah.
In fact, the whole paper is sourced. The whole of paper 99.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. The entire paper.
Is it from one source or is it?
From it's from two. There are two different sources.
Who are they?
One is Henry Nelson Wyman, and his wife, by the way, this is one of the women, Regina Wyman.
How do you
spell
that? Pardon?
W-I-E-M-A-N.
Okay.
And the second is a man named Garnett. A. Campbell Garnett, and his one of the issues with his work is it was published in 1942.
Okay, what are the names of the books that those are?
Well, Wyman's book is entitled Normative Psychology of Religion, and it is a major source.
Okay,
anyone interested in studying this would probably find it useful to begin with that book, with Wyman's Normative Psychology, because it's a relatively easy read, and so much of it is used in different sections, particularly of the religion papers.
And what about the Garnett book? What's that one called?
The Garnett book is called A Realistic Philosophy of Religion.
Okay. Now, you know, this might be a good time to do two things. One is I want to give out our phone number again for those who want to call in and ask about this, 646-716-8158, 646-716-8158. But what I really want to get into is this. Steve, I think it's important people to recognize that when we say that the book uses human sources, they didn't just in most cases at least, they didn't just quote verbatim from the source. They did more than that. They actually sometimes, in most cases, altered something that the source author said. Is that correct?
Virtually always alter what the source author says. Although, much of the time, the two are saying the same thing. It's just not said in the same way. Now, sometimes there are alterations that you'd have to call revelatory. Right? Material is added to the source material, or the source material is adjusted in some way that makes it a revelatory addition. For example, generally when the thought adjuster is introduced into a passage, right?
Okay.
The inner spirit, that usually almost always is not present in the source discussion.
Right, and by the way, I want people to recognize that there is plenty of unique material in the Aranthal.
Oh, yeah, there's no question.
It's not as if the whole book is, because, you know, the whole concept of something being
pre-produced. The whole book is unique.
Right,
you know,
and the whole concept of something being pre-personal is something that I've never encountered it anywhere outside the Aranthal book.
I can't say I know of a source for that particularly. There may be one, but I'm not familiar with it.
Right.
And so, Steve, what you're saying in a sense is that the concept of thought adjuster, even in that phraseology, is pretty unique and unique to the Urantia book, correct? Would you say that?
Well, of course, the term thought adjuster is unique to the Urantia book. The inner spirit, the concept of an inner spirit or the indwelling spirit of God, is not unique to the Urantia book. That's a that concept's been around since Jesus. However, and when I say it's an addition to the source material, the source author is not attributing whatever the source author is talking about to the work of the inner spirit, right? However, when the Urantia book takes the source author's words or concepts, right, better concepts, they add to it the influence and presence of the thought adjuster as an explanation for what's going on. Right?
Can you give us an example of that?
Right off, I'd have to dig through. I mean, it's not an uncommon thing. I'll flip around, see if I can.
If
I can find one, it occurs with some frequency.
I have a couple callers. Hold on.
Oh, good.
This one I know is Ann because it's 11-11s all the way across. Hi, Ann. Are you there? This is Paula, and you're on Blog Talk. Ann? Well, maybe not.
Maybe it's not Ann. Maybe it's just 11-11 is showing up. Who's on the air?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi there.
Oh,
hi there.
Joe.
Who's this?
This is Joer.
Oh, hi, Joer. You showed up as 11-11-11-11-11.
How about that? That's been happening more often now. I never paid attention to it before. Anyway, I had a question. The question for Steve was, you know, it's about the stuff with the source authors, you know, the human source authors and the celestial authors, and about any skepticism that might have raised. I've noticed on the blog they talked about that a little bit with giving up veneration of the book and that seems to be a good thing, but I was just wondering how he and Matthew or others have they encountered any skepticism and how they've resolved it within themselves. It still seems, you know, impressive to me, like you were talking about the uniqueness of the book, and it is, and it's very impressive. And so I was just wondering if, you know, if that raised any questions in their minds about the divine basis of the book.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Oh, this is Joer. Hi, Steve.
Joe?
Yeah, Joe. I saw you at the ICOA conference.
Oh,
doing
hi,
your,
Joe.
Doing your personality speech.
Oh, okay.
Great.
Well, look, the answer is that the study of this subject, right, and if you get involved in this, almost inevitably questions are going to be raised I suppose you could put into in the category of skepticism, because you're going to run into things that you didn't expect,
right?
And you're going to make discoveries that you didn't expect to make. You probably are going to pause and say, you know, what do I make of this or what do I make of that? How am I to understand this? That has happened with some people. I know of cases where people have actually abandoned the book on the basis of what I would call a very superficial study of the sources.
Is that something like Gardner's perspective and what happened with him?
Well, no, I don't think, you know, I don't consider Gardner a good example because he never was a believer.
Well, I heard that
right? Gardner was a skeptic, but I'm talking about people who have been were involved with the book, were convinced that it was a revelation, and then, you know, they came across a bit of information about the sources that kind of shock them sufficiently so that they became disillusioned with the book. I've known several people that have gone through this, and I've also known people that go through it and then come back to get over it, right? So the answer is the discovery of these source relationships is bound to cause some confusion in individuals, some more in some than others. That's just inevitable. The specific nature of that, I can't really explain to you because it has to do with the detail that people run into. And
right.
You never know what detail is going to be upsetting to what person, right? So there's just no way of knowing that. The issue here, I think, is to remember that the book, the revelation of the Urantia book is in its entirety and not in any one part of it or any one section.
Right.
Right? The great service that the book accomplishes for a person is to make them feel, as the book says, at home in the universe.
Wow.
To know where they've come from, who they are, right? Where they're going, right? To know something about the design purpose of the universe, the beings who inhabit it, the way it's administered, all of these things, right? And anyone who studies the book thoroughly ends up with a consciousness of this that is present with them all the time.
Would you say, Steve, that the ascension scheme concept is a pretty unique concept?
Yes. Of the idea that there is eternal life is not unique with the book. The idea that eternal life constitutes an experience of constant growth, of continued growth and development and accomplishment and service, that's not unique with the book, right?
Right. No. Because there are people.
The structure of the specific detail about the mansion worlds and the system and the constellation, the universe, that's all unique.
The cosmology. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think a lot of times people have couched that kind of thing in terms of reincarnation, the idea that we'll be growing, you know, from life to life. But whereas the book is really talking more about being resurrected into higher states, which, I mean, that's not totally unique to the Erasmus book, but
no.
I think the way that they describe it and present it is pretty unique.
Well, yes. I mean, it occurs in other writings, but only I would say, in passing, only as a thought. And then in the Erasmus book, there's a detailed elaboration of that concept or that thought. But in any case, to answer, you know, to go back to Joe's question, the study of these sources, I'd have to say you undertake it at your own risk. Right.
Right. I actually find it exciting. I found that the things that you said, I've been reading the book probably, you know, close to 30 years, and everything you've said so far rings true with me in terms of how it changes you, in terms of making you feel at home here and in the universe and in the eternal scheme. You know, it does. It changes.
Okay, so that's, you know, that's what you have to hold on to while you engage in these source studies.
And I'll tell you something.
Right? That's your faith conviction about the nature of reality.
And I can only speak for myself, Joe, and say that this is Andre calling. I can only say for myself that, you know what, I actually did reject the book for a while. But the source study, looking at the sources actually, to me, it authenticated the book for me. It actually confirmed, because first of all, the book is exactly what it claims to be. I mean, they, like I said before, they admit to using these sources. So when you find out how they use them, you know, that to me just authenticates the book. The other reason it authenticates it for me is because a lot of the ideas that the book builds on, in other words, I can see how the book builds on the ideas that were already around. But in fact, I think, wouldn't you say, Steve, that you could even make a case that sometimes when they correct the source authors, it's almost like they're dialoguing with the authors.
Yes, I would. You sometimes get that feeling.
It certainly seems like they did it on purpose.
There's a dialogue with the author. That's true.
Yeah. We have another call, don't we, Paul?
Okay.
Yes, we do. Thank you
very much.
Yeah. Okay.
God bless you guys.
Before we get to that call, I just want to point out two things, or one thing actually, but I'll use two examples. And I've brought this example up on the air before, but, you know, there are plenty of places where the Urantia book corrects the Bible, for example. The one that I like to quote the most is where it says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked." But when Jesus says that in the Urantia book, he says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and sometimes desperately wicked." So the word "sometimes," you know, changes the meaning entirely. The other one that, Steve, you've brought up to me is the one where in the Bible it says, "If any man be in Christ Jesus, he is a new creature. Old things are passing away. Behold, all things have become new." In the Urantia book, it says, "If any man has Christ Jesus within him, behold, all things are passing away. Behold, all things." So again, there's that slight reworking of the phrase, which just really adds such a. And so they do that not only with the Bible; they do that with these human sources that we're talking about. Let's go to another caller here. Who's
by the way, Andre?
Go ahead.
Well, there's another point that ought to be made. Go to the caller. That's okay.
Okay, we'll do that. Hold on. 212, you're on Blog Talk.
This is Casey. How are you? Hi, Paula.
Casey, how are you doing? Gosh, this is the first time we've heard you on the show here.
I know. I think it's terrific. Thanks for doing it.
You're welcome.
Hi, Casey.
Hi, Steve. If you want to make your point, I can hold my question, or you can return to it.
Well, it's a relatively quick point. You know, the question that was asked was, can the study of these sources lead to skepticism? And the answer is yes, it can. And, I would say to some degree it probably will, but I wouldn't worry too much about that. As long as you can hold on to your view of the whole, that shouldn't be much of a problem. You know, the skepticism, if it's pursued, can lead to useful insights. Now, on the other hand, there's something else that happens with the study of the sources, and that is that it can provide a much deeper understanding of the material that you're reading in the Urantia.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And I say that because the degree of condensation used between the source and the book, it can be of the order of 100 to 1. That is, 100 pages of a source book may be condensed into 1 page of the Urantia book.
Wow.
Okay? So there's an extremely high degree of condensation.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'll give you an example. Hold on. All right, I'm finding it. You know that you remember the statement, "Sin must be redefined as..."
Yes, yes.
"Delivered to..." Everybody knows that one, right? Because that's a, you know, if this is a religious venture for you, then you would have paid attention to that statement in the book. So I'm going to read the whole thing to you. It says, "Sin must be defined as deliberate disloyalty to deity. There are degrees of disloyalty, the partial loyalty of indecision, the divided loyalty of confliction, the dying loyalty of indifference, and the death of loyalty exhibited in the devotion to godless ideals. That's it, two sentences, right? Okay,
wow.
That correlates with six pages in the source book discussing
wow.
that same topic. Six pages. Are we still there?
Yeah.
No, you're saying that that's...
Okay, so now what I'm saying is you can grasp the meaning of the statement, sin must be redefined as deliberate disloyalty to deity. Okay, that's fine. That's graspable. But the other four points that are made, there are degrees of disloyalty, partial indecision, divided loyalty, indifference, and devotion to godless ideals, those four things. You don't have a clue what they're talking about unless you read the source material.
Where does that come from? Where does that come from?
You don't. I mean, you can guess at what they're talking about.
Where does that come from?
It comes from that same book we mentioned before, Normative Psychology of Religion.
So does Wyman say in that book that sin should be redefined?
He simply says sin is disloyalty to deity.
Oh, I see. Correct me if I'm wrong, he didn't believe in a personal God, though, did he?
No, Wyman was a deist, but that's a more complicated matter. I'm not sure we want to go into that now. It's another very interesting avenue to explore, and the answer is no. He did not believe in a personal God, nor did he believe in an afterlife.
Wow.
Right. But he is among the more heavily used source authors.
Interesting.
In some of the critical areas. For example, you know, another passage that your ancient book readers are familiar with are the conditions of effective prayer, right? In the prayer paper, that's also Wyman from the same book.
Wow.
And I'd make the same statement. I'd say if you read those conditions, right, which occur on half a page in six or seven lines, you're probably not going to understand it nearly as well as if you read the corresponding source passage in Wyman's book, which is also called entitled Conditions of Effective Prayer.
Now, I want to make sure Casey gets her question.
Yeah.
Casey, before we do that, I want to say what this says to me. This is so fascinating to me, because what it says to me is that, you know, the revelators don't care where the truth comes from. They don't care if it comes from someone who didn't believe in an afterlife. They don't care. You know, to me, it's kind of like Paul using pagan ideas in Acts chapter 17 when he's trying to talk to the Athenians on Mars Hill. Now, he has no problem using, hymns to Zeus and all kinds of other stuff to make his point. So to put it in theological terms or Christian terms or spiritual terms, you know, God can use an unbeliever too, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can call it an unbeliever, but truth is truth.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
I would rather say God is no respecter of persons.
That's what
wherever the truth comes from.
That's right. Casey, why don't you go ahead and ask your and tell us what you want to talk about?
It's perfect timing. It's a great segue into what I was calling about, Steve. I wanted to follow up on Andre's question earlier, and even though it puts you a little bit on the spot to do a comparative study side by side, taking one paragraph from the source book and comparing that to, as you just did, with the conditions of effective prayer and sin, I was struck once when I saw you do a larger study in a workshop that I had this thought. I had this thought that what if I took my own thoughts as if it was a source book and put it through the same filter that the revelators used in taking these human thoughts, kind of turning them on their head a little bit, turning them in such a way as to uplift them, and what would, if I could examine my own thoughts that way. So my question is, have you noticed any pattern that you could describe in how these sources are reframed by the revelators? And I think you've already given one example just about in your discussion of personalism, that all through the book there's a way that you take a top-down approach, that everything comes from personality. That's maybe one framework from which we can examine all of our thoughts.
Mm. Casey, let me get this a little clearer now. What you're saying is if you look at the at the way the sources have been used? Can you get some clue into what, how you might replicate that process using your own thinking, or what?
Yeah, it just seems to me that when just as you take those six pages of human science
okay,
condensed into one.
Right. Can you do that with your own? Well, here's what I've thought about this, for what it's worth. You said, what's occurred to me was that all these works date from, as I said, you know, roughly 1890 to 1942. Well, you know, it's now 2008, right? And there have been lots more works published since 1942. So the question that comes up in my mind, which I've asked people, I've said, and I've asked 50 and 60 year old people, right, as well as younger people. So people who've read dozens and dozens of books, hundreds maybe. Mm-hmm. I've said to them, is there any book you've read, right, in the course of your life that you think is so good, it has so much useful material in it that if the Urantia book were being produced today, it could conceivably be selected as a source book? Have you read any book like that?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can only think of one particular author that I think. Well, see, it's funny. Well, go ahead.
Well, okay. So that, you know, I've actually get very, very few answers to this question. Now, one answer I did get from a longtime reader was very interesting. She said, "The Power of Now."
Eckhart Tolle.
Yes. Right. Well, there is nothing, none of the source books are anything like the Eckhart Tolle book, right? That is a totally different genre of material. So it's just an interesting thing to think about. You know, it's another interesting question.
But you know what? I think what you're saying is really valid, but I also have to stand by something that I was trying to kind of put across earlier, which was that I believe, and I didn't actually say this, but I believe the Urantia book came to us at exactly the right time, because I believe that the intellectual, philosophical, and spiritual soil really were ripe at that particular time, riper than they are today. I think it would be, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think it would be more difficult for the authors to find source material today if they were writing today, because I just don't think that the trends are the same today. I mean, I just don't think, you know, we talked about some of those trends that were around back then. There was a belief in progress that was very popular. There was, you know, this trend of personalism. There was this trend of, you know, Protestant liberalism was not what it is today. Today it's just degenerated into left-wing politics and postmodern relativism. You know, it's just not what – I think it would be more difficult. I'm not saying it wouldn't be possible. The only contemporary author that I can think of, and he just passed away a few years ago, the only person I can think of that I think the Revelators could have possibly used is the work of M. Scott Peck, who wrote The Road Less Traveled and some other books. I thought, you know, that's the closest thing I
know. All right, so you see, we've got two suggestions so far, right? M. Scott Peck and Eckhart Tolle. It's just a question, you know, and the question is asked to stimulate thought, right, to continue inquiry. That's all. That's the purpose of it.
Yeah.
Where it leads, who knows where it leads? I don't know. By the way, Casey, here's just another point that you might find interesting. The level of condensation of the book, right, where sources are used is what I expressed to you. You know, it gets up near 100 to 1 sometimes. So I always find it interesting when people then try to condense the book, because it's like condensed milk, whatever that is. You know, it's like taking condensed milk and condensing it. I mean, I'm not saying don't do it. I think it's an interesting exercise, useful exercise. But I think it's also useful to understand what you're doing when you do that.
Well, and you know, Steve, I have to point out that I think Casey was getting at the fact that and correct me if I'm wrong, Casey, she kind of asked you if there's a pattern that you've noticed that they shift the concept up a notch. And I think this is an intriguing idea, because if I understand you correctly, Casey, we can all do the same thing. We can shift our thinking up a notch by contemplating the meaning of things and then adding value to it. And that's essentially what I think they've done. As I've seen some of these source authors, I've read a lot of Matthew's comparisons side by side, and I marvel at how they took the concept and they tuned it up a notch. And how much more meaningful it is now. I mean, you said essentially they said the same thing, and yet in the second version, it's much more succinct and more meaningful to me. And I find that interesting.
It's been my experience too, Paula, that I marvel at how a thought, a human thought, is uplifted. And it makes me think that this is one of the great values of getting into and discovering these source books and studying them, is that it gives us an avenue for learning how to study not only the Urantia teachings better, but our own thoughts.
Yeah, and even the thoughts of others, Eckhart Tolle, you know, anybody. We can take that, whether we absolutely agree with it or not, and find the kernel of truth in it and upstep it a little bit so that it adds meaning and value for us.
Well, and to me, the thing to me that studying the human sources is a little bit like the importance, if you're going to study the Bible, you know, to get a lexicon, you know, a Greek lexicon or a Hebrew lexicon, you know, if you're going to study, you know, find out some things about the historical context, what was going on at that time. You know, I think, again, you know, as I said before, I think that the trends that were going on, I guess that what I was saying before about how I think it'd be harder for them to find human sources today, I guess it's kind of like asking, you know, could Jesus have come earlier or later than he did? Sure, he could have, but I think he came at the right time, and I believe that the Urantia book was given to us at the right time. Do we have any other callers showing up, Paula?
We have two more callers, so
okay.
Thank you so much, my dear.
Hi, Casey.
Hello, you're on Blog Talk.
Who is this?
Hello.
Hi, it's Ann. It was another 11:11, so I wasn't sure.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ann.
I always come in as 11:11. Yeah, I was born 11:11:47, so we don't know what's going on. Steve, great to hear from you. I love your mind. I want to see a cross section of it someday.
Yes.
I do have a question. First of all, about people that have fallen away from the book. I've often said, and I have talked to some of those people in the past, trying to help them come to grips with it, and we either understand the book through our minds, our human mind, sheer intellect, or through the window of faith. And I find that people that have come into the book through only the mind circuits, the human mind circuits, without that window of faith, of being agendonters, that's the pattern that I've noticed, that they fall away. Second thing I want to say, I do love the source, the source books. The first one I came across was in 1993, Paula, when we were at the Parliament of World Religions, and we stayed at the Fellowship House, right?
Uh-huh.
And Bundy and Jones. And I remember, I'm just thankful for my biblical background, that it didn't threaten me at all. In fact, it excited me and encouraged me. And the third thing I'd like to ask, Steve, if you and I have talked briefly about this before, some of us just recently went to Los Angeles. And while I was there, I was at the conference. Well, I took time to visit with some other friends, Urantia Book readers that don't participate, our daughter, and several other people that I hadn't seen in 20 years. When I go somewhere, I don't wait, you know, I say, well, if I'm here to see one person, I'm going to see a lot of people. Could it be possible these human sources kicked in gear in the late 1800s, and even your great scholars, your great prophets, your great seers talk about that was a huge surge of revelation. Then it kicked back in gear, called the Voice of Healing Days in Christianity, in the 50s, which I find interesting. Could it be possible that some of these human sources were gleaning information through their thought adjusters during that same time frame? Because I know today, I'm very blessed, there are prophets and seers on the planet today that know nothing about the Urantia book, that are getting information even as we speak.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, revelation
So that puts a different light on the community.
You know, as an individual phenomena, it's continuous.
Well, that
auto-revelation.
So,
yeah, puts a different light on the human sources.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, let me give you, let's go back to Toll, right, Eckhart Toll. I read, if I read through The Power of Now, this very popular book by Eckhart Tolle, at various points in his discussion, I think to myself, he's talking about the soul there, but he's not using the term soul. Or, he's talking about the thought adjuster there, right? But he's not using that term. Nor is he using the term inner spirit, right? In other words, the interesting thing is to look at these texts, right, in terms of the model of reality that you're given in the Urantia book, and see if you can make sense out of them on that basis, because that's what the revelators did with the source books. See, they took the source books, right, looked at them from their model of reality, right, and re-express them, right, including these missing pieces. It's a really interesting exercise.
Well, I know there's other people holding. I'll just quickly say and hang up that a dear friend of mine that has already left the planet was preached until in his late 80s. He never knew the Urantia book. He began to preach a long time ago about there being a body, a mind, a soul, and a spirit, an eternal spirit. He came under great persecution in Christianity, and he had some other thoughts that let me know this man is truly, and he and I talked privately toward the end of his life about this, and he was ecstatic the last 2 years of his life. To know that there was other information on the planet that confirmed what he said. God bless you, Steve. And bye, Paula. Bye, Andre.
Thank
bye,
you.
Bye, Ann.
We have another caller, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Okay, how are we doing on time, by the way?
We've got 36 minutes.
Okay, good. All right, who do we have on here?
We have Dave from Ottawa. Hi, Dave. Dave, are you there? Quester? Dave? Well, I guess Dave's not there.
Okay. Was that our last caller?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve, I want to make sure there's a point I really want to address here. I want to make sure that we get this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is very controversial, but what are skeptics going to say when we tell them about human sources? They're going to say plagiarism. The Urantia book was plagiarized in major portion. Okay, what do we say to that?
Well, you say that's correct. You're correct. I mean, I think most people who hear this term plagiarism don't really understand what it is, and they take it as a heavy negative, and I don't know. It seems to stimulate all the defense mechanism, you know, to protect the book. But plagiarism, the term plagiarism occurs mostly in an academic setting, right, in universities, or in academic endeavors of one kind.
But it could also occur in a copyright situation. Let's say
the copyright's a different matter. Let's just talk about plagiarism right now. Plagiarism simply means using someone else's ideas, right, without giving specific credit for those ideas. Specific credit.
Okay.
Not general. Right? You're not allowed to say at the beginning of a work that you produce, I've used a lot of ideas from different people, right? And then to go ahead and use those ideas without specifically citing them, saying this idea that I'm using here, right, even though I've completely reworked it, right, I've changed all the words and the order and everything, I've changed it, it comes from this book by this author, right? That's the only way a work can be free from plagiarism. And that's just in the definition of the term, okay? So now in academic settings, plagiarism is not acceptable. You can't do this academically, right? If you're a student and you're writing a paper and you don't give credit to your sources, you're going to get in big trouble. If you're a professor and you do this, you may lose your job, right? It's considered a big deal.
Okay, why
now? Now, the Urantia book is not an academic work, right? It's not a paper that's being handed in a university. It's not the work of a professor. It's a completely different document that sits in a completely different domain. Did it make wide use of sources without specifically citing them? Well, obviously it did. I mean, clearly it did. Is that the definition of plagiarism? Yes, it is.
Okay, let me ask you.
Okay, so that's just a fact. Does it discredit the book? No.
Okay, let me ask
you. Yeah, I mean, that's the point. Why conclude that discredits the book? Well, you might say, why didn't they cite? You know, why didn't they initially put all these citations in? One reason is it would have greatly diminished the impact, the ability of the book to reach people, if you had hundreds upon hundreds of footnotes and citations all over the place. Right? I mean, just imagine what the book would have looked like. Just for one thing. Now, there are lots of other reasons I could give you. I won't give them to you now. I don't see it as a problem. That would be my argument.
Well, let me ask you one question.
Well, Andre, the switchboards have lit up. Would you like me to take another call? Hold on.
I'm sure it has. Okay,
yes, it has. Hold on.
Let's see here.
514, you're on Cosmic Citizen. Hello.
I don't see this problem.
514? Are you there?
That's Diane, but we can't hear her.
Okay, we're having a problem because, folks, if you call in, please tune down your computer so that you can hear. Here's another call. Let's try this one. 613, you're on the Cosmic Citizen. Are you there?
Hi, Paula.
Hi.
I got through this time. I tried using Click to Call on your website, and I did connect. And when you acknowledged me, there was supposed to be a button titled Accept that would let me finish the connection, but it didn't show up. So I called back PSTN.
Well, this is Dave from Ottawa. Hi, Dave. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Hi, David.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
I just had a couple of questions for Steve. Well, one question, one comment. I guess the comment is for everybody. You've been noticing people calling in as 111111111.
Exactly.
When we set up the Blog Talk Radio feature for our study group, I learned that means the caller is probably using Skype.
Oh.
So just so you know, apparently if you call in using Skype, that's the ID you see on your switchboard.
Okay. Hmm.
Thank you. But the question I have for Steve, and hi, Steve, it sure is a pleasure hearing you talk about this subject.
Hello, Dave. Nice to hear your voice.
You mention that the sources run through to 1942.
That's correct.
And here my ignorance is going to show. I had the impression, I'm not sure where I got it, but I had the impression that the papers were finalized in 1934 or thereabouts. Go ahead.
That's the general impression because the dates 1934 and 1935 are in the book. But there are source materials, as I say, up to 1942. Well, most of them occur before that. And in addition to that, there is other testimony from people who were present at the time the the book was being received, who also say that adjustments to the papers were made after 34 and 35.
Yeah, I believe that. I believe that that's the case for a lot of reasons. That's a whole other subject, but I think there were some revisions.
Right, right. So, you know, the point is that, once again, the 34-35 dates, while it's a reasonable conclusion based upon what you find in the book, don't seem to be sufficient to give a person a complete sense of the situation.
And there's really no way to date those papers, is there? I mean, to know exactly when they did show up or...
Well, they say, you know, that they put them down in they indicted them in 34 or 35. Of course, that doesn't mean that they couldn't be edited subsequent to that. But
sure, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for clearing that up. I was really confused.
Yeah.
How could a source published in 1942 get into a 1934 set of papers?
Right. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because let me say something else about this. When these sources were first discovered, and that point was made, right, that some of these sources date from 1936, right, or 1942, and the book says 34-35, there was a need in the minds of some people to come up with explanations for this, that is to engage in apologetics. One person, I remember, told me that he had figured this out. This guy was a university professor, still is. He had figured this out. He knows how a book from 1942 could contain ideas from the Urantia book, and the answer was the person gained access to the manuscript somehow at Diversey, right? Earlier, stole the ideas, and subsequently published them in his book.
So that suggestion is the sourcing is reversed. Urantia book sourced from human sources. It's human sources sourced from the Urantia
book. That's what this person said. And you know what it reminds me of? When creationists say the Earth is 6,000 years old, right? And then people say, well, how do you account for the fossils, the dinosaur fossils? Their answer is, well, God created those in the Earth as we find them 6,000 years ago. There never really were any dinosaurs. Or an argument will be made to creationists. They'll say, well, you know, what about this light that comes to us from thousands of light years away, right? If everything was created 6,000 years ago, how can that be? And their answer to that is, well, when God created everything 6,000 years ago, he created the light in transit, right? It was already on its way. I mean, now arguments like this, really, say more about the faith of the person making the argument, right, the weakness of that faith, frankly, than they do about the issue at hand, right? I mean, I think the truth never suffers from an honest examination, as the book teaches, and we should never be afraid to move forward with the truth as best we can understand it. And one thing we do not need to do is to develop silly apologetic arguments about to account for the presence of these things.
Yeah.
And the idea that somebody broke into Diversey Parkway sometime in the early 1930s, and that's where they got the ideas for their 1942 book, is silly.
It is silly. You know, I know we have callers. We have other callers, but there are just two things I want to interject, and then I'm going to really leave the show to the rest of the show to the callers. Just two things. One is, I don't have a problem personally with the idea that there were revisions made after 1935, because we know that there was a process of dialogue with the Contact Commission and the Revelators and all. And I've long suspected there were revisions. And I'll just give you one example. At the end of paper 82, there's a section on race mixtures. And this is a paper that's about marriage. It's got nothing to do with the races. It's a paper on the evolution of marriage. It's a section on race mixtures. It's just there at the end of the paper by itself. And it talks about how you don't have to worry about race mixing. You know, most of the concerns about race mixing come from social and cultural prejudices. Race mixing is pretty much okay. And most of that stuff, the stuff in that paper comes from a book called Race, Man's Most Dangerous Myth by Ashley Montague, which was written in 1941. Now, what that doesn't bother me, and the reason it doesn't bother me is I think it's quite possible that section, as I said before, remember that section is at the end of the paper on marriage, has nothing to do with the rest of the paper. It's almost like it was added there as a kind of addendum or parenthesis. And I think that what was going on is that, you know, probably the contact commission or the forum people, you know, the forum members were asking about race mixing and, you know, got a response to their question, and it was added to the text. The other thing is I think they were also trying to soften some of the earlier harsher rhetoric about race that was in some of the earlier papers. So, I mean, again, this kind of stuff doesn't bother me at all. In fact, to me, if anything, it just shows the process of dialogue that was going on between the revelators and the
Andre,
commission.
And what a process.
Andre?
Yes?
When you say added to the text, are you suggesting that added by human hand, or are you suggesting that
no.
the revelators,
no.
in fact, decided to
no, the revelators,
what
no, the revelators added.
Indicted?
No, I'm saying the revelators added it.
I that was a question more for clarity than it was to
yeah.
answer.
Yeah,
thanks.
No, that's fine. The other question I want to ask you, Steve, is when you talk about plagiarism, you said that parts of the book were plagiarized, and we should just accept that. Doesn't plagiarism, though, maybe technically that's true, but usually I think when people think of plagiarism, don't they usually think there's an element of deception in it, like where you use sources without letting people know that you're using sources? In other words, you know, the revelators tell us that they're using these sources.
Right.
So isn't that more of a, I guess maybe what they're doing is, I guess that's usually what I think of when I think of plagiarism. I mean, I realize that technically, I suppose it is plagiarized because they don't cite things, they don't give us footnotes.
That's correct. The answer is sure, and mostly in plagiarism is an attempt at deception going on. That's clearly the case. Although, you know, even if a plagiarism occurs unconsciously, and it's still plagiarism. Motive is not an element in plagiarism. It's simply defined on the factual basis of the relationship between the material and the source material. That's all. That's all it is. And it's a look. You know, the reason I mention this is not a problem internally. It's not a problem for me at all. And the likelihood is it's not going to be a problem for anybody who has grasped the gestalt of the Urantia book, right? And for whom it has become their understanding of the nature of reality. But this is one of the ways in which the book is going to be attacked from the outside by those who are hostile to it. And I mention this in the same sense that Jesus said to the apostles, listen, guys, they're going to come after me, and they're going to come after you. Warn them, right? So they wouldn't be surprised
yeah.
when it happened. And that's mainly the reason I mention it. Just be ready for it. You know, understand that if the book becomes better known, and if and when people think that somehow, you know, it has to be counted. Right, you have to destroy it or defeat it. This is just one of the arguments they make, and when they make it, just be calm. Don't come up with some complex explanation that the rest of the world can't understand. Don't give them a cultic explanation that only members of the cult can understand. Just say, yes, right, you're right, that's true, but there's a lot more to it.
And you know what, Steve, that comment by the Midwayer on that very topic is so definitive, I think. And, you know, it's like we talked about the origins of the book and the other with Larry, and these questions come up, and we have to get good at answering them, and we have to, and the only way we get good at answering them is by practicing with people when they ask, what about this issue? And you tell them, well, you know, this is my thinking on that. And, you know, I absolutely agree with you that these nonsensical answers about, you know, that are based purely on faith, you know, perhaps the author was stealing from the revelators. You know, all sources, we as readers, we know that everything comes from the first great source and center of all things, that nothing is new to God, and God can't plagiarize anything, you know, but that word plagiarism puts you off. It's like saying somebody's a thief. So,
well,
you know,
that's true. I mean, it puts people off, which is why you need to get used to it, right?
Yeah, and you need to get...
You know, I'll say again, it's not a problem. It
yeah.
is not a problem. It does, you know, if you have a good knowledge of the source relationships, a good knowledge of the whole, the gestalt of the Urantia book, there's no reason for this to be a problem.
Right.
Not, you know, and if, I mean, if you want to understand more about why, first of all, let me say something else. The problem will be corrected probably sometime within the next 50 years.
Wow.
That is, somebody is going to publish a version of the
annotated
contains all the citations.
Yeah.
Right? That's not the one you're going to read every day because it would be too difficult to read. That's the academic version. So it'll cease to be a problem at that point.
That's right. And that's something that should happen. We have annotated Bibles. We have annotated, you know.
That's correct. Yeah.
We have some more callers, don't we, here the last few
Yeah,
minutes.
We do. Bro, Dave, thanks, Dave, for calling in.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye, Dave.
And I'll hang up now and give somebody else a chance. Cheers,
okay.
all.
Bye, Dave.
God bless. Area code 514, you're on Blog Talk.
Am I coming in?
Yes, you are, Diane. You're here.
Hi, Steve.
Diane.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Paul Hi. And Andre. I just wanted to share something because as I was listening to you, Steve, talk, I just had this idea of the, it's like a hidden message about skepticism, and the reason why I'm calling is that if this can help people, because I have met skeptics as well, and it is the beautiful story of the caveman in the Urantia book. You know, when they say if you look at them at first, you tend to judge, but when you enlarge the picture, you actually admire the courage of the man. So I was thinking that these men and women that you were mentioning, Steve, who happened to be marginal or original thinkers of their time, to me, I think it should be to their credit that the authors have chosen them as references, you know. It means that they were connected with their adjusters to the point that their thoughts, the thoughts that they expressed, were so close to the truth as to be worthy to serve as reference in this monumental revelation of the Urantia Papers. So instead of skepticism, to me, it should make us into believers. It should bring the human being as being so worthy to have such great thoughts. It should prove that what happened to just a few can happen and actually should happen to more and more of us, you know. So,
Diane, one of the things that I think is so great about the human sources is a lot of these, one of the reasons I like studying them is because a lot of these sources they used were just fantastic thinkers. I mean, there's one guy in particular that they don't use much, but there was a Protestant preacher named Harry Emerson Fosdick, who was just, I mean, I did a whole performance based on his life when I was in college, and he was that good. And the book doesn't use him that much. They only use him in one place that I know of. But a lot of the concepts he talked about are concepts that are used in the book. For example, he has a book called Christianity and Progress. Another book he has is called Adventurous Religion. You know, he talked a lot about the religion of Jesus versus the religion about Jesus. I mean, so many of these things, I mean, I think it would behoove us as readers to look at, because some of these thinkers were such, we could be inspired by them. And they're just, and by the way, Steve, these weren't all, correct me if I'm wrong, these weren't all marginal thinkers either.
Oh, no. I didn't use that word marginal. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to give that impression. They're not marginal. They were forces, right, in the field, because they were a minority representing a position that was falling out of favor, and they held on. I mean, they held their academic positions. That's the point.
Were they really a minority though?
But philosophy and theology had become captivated by the new physics, and was wandering off into a much more mathematical way of looking at things. Right? It had become less concerned with morals and ethics, and the academic careers were no longer being built on those subjects. Right? They were being built based on the discoveries of quantum mechanics and similar things.
Wow. Okay.
Right? That's
could
what
you
was
say
going
that they
on.
Were? Could you say that they were original thinkers then?
I would say they were, in some cases, extraordinary original thinkers. And I,
right.
You know, I don't mean to say that they were. I don't know quite how to put this. That they were not among the outstanding members of their fields. For example, one of them, a man named Charles Hartshorne, who only died a few years ago, by the way. I think he was 104 years old. It's viewed by some as among the greatest of the philosophers of the past century, right? of the last century. And with good reason, too. He was a brilliant man, extraordinary man. His contribution to the Urantia book, among other things, well, there's two things I can think of. You know that list of the, when we attempt to conceive of perfection in all of its phases, right in the foreword? Absolute perfection,
yes,
in all respects, right?
Yes.
Absolute in some, relative in others. That's Hartshorne.
Hmm.
Right up front there in the foreword. It's Charles Hartshorne. But I'll say this. You don't have a clue why that's there or what it means unless you read some of Hartshorne's book. Right? That's what I discovered. It was only after reading the reason Hartshorne developed that list that I understood what the point was.
See, this is where you're getting at about...
By the way, I'll tell you what it is. It's an argument for the supreme being. That's what it is.
Well, the other thing is, okay. you're also...
And by the way, let me give you the other tidbit.
Okay.
The other phrase, right, which is very dear to Urantia book readers, which is attributed to Hartshorne in this same book, a few pages later, is love is the desire to do good to others. It's the phrase that ends section two, the last thing in section two. So it hangs there all by itself.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to go and thank you, Steve, for enlarging my focus.
A pleasure.
It brought me to the caveman story, and instead of skepticism, it turns me into an even firmer believer.
Good.
Thank you. Bye.
Good for you. Good for you. And Steve, I want to say real quick, and that is that, you know, I think this is another argument for the authors wanting to conserve some of these thinkers and these thoughts. Because I think if it wasn't for the Urantia book, a lot of these books, I think even Matthew said, a lot of these books would be lost in obscurity. A lot of these concepts would be lost in obscurity. Because, I mean, I don't think that people like Charles Hartshorne are really popular today on you know, in academic circles, are they?
No.
Right. And so that's why, again, I would say it would just behoove us to read some of these thinkers. How much more time do we have, Paula?
Well, we have 11 minutes. And,
okay,
and
do you have any more callers?
Huh?
Do we have any more callers?
No.
No, okay.
I want to ask Steve. Steve, of all the source authors you found, who do you think is the most popular or the most famous, let's say, the most widely read and respected author?
Gosh, you know, it's hard to think of any of them as famous or widely read in that sense. I mean, there'd be individuals like Hartshorne, who would have been well known amongst philosophers. There's a Harvard philosopher who is a source, William Hocking, who was well known back then, right? In the fields of philosophy, but I'm not even sure I can answer that question fully, because I don't know how famous, for example, Henry Wyman was. I've never looked into that. I just don't know.
Would you say that they were relatively, for the most part, obscure to the mainstream?
Yeah, these source books are not the sort of book that, you know, would have been a runaway bestseller, like let's say The Power of Now. You know, they're not that sort of work. They're often textbooks.
Although the guy I mentioned earlier, Harry Emerson Fosdick,
is one. Overstreet's another that published popular works. Lewis Brown is another. Right, the published popular works, but if you're talking about something like Edesheim, that's a scholar's book.
Okay.
Right.
The other, I want to also bring up. Okay, there's a very controversial passage of the book though, that I want to bring up before we close, and that is the paper on Rodin of Alexandria. Now, a lot of that paper was taken, correct me if I'm wrong, from Henry Wyman, right?
That's the second Wyman source book, right?
Right.
The first one is Normative Psychology, which I've mentioned before, and that's the one I'd recommend people to have a look at if they want to get rolling on these sources.
But this is where. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because, again, some readers may think they feel like they're being deceived because they think they're getting the actual words of Rodin when they're actually getting Henry Wyman's words. But see, I guess the reason that doesn't bother me now is because I was thinking. We're not even getting the actual words of Jesus in a lot of these cases. First of all, whenever the authors say, in modern phraseology and in substance, Jesus said, in most cases, 9 times out of 10, that's sourced material from a human source. Okay, but the other thing is, of course, whenever Jesus' words had to be translated into English anyway, but the thing that's interesting to me is, what does it say right at the beginning of Part 4, that acknowledgement that Paula read earlier? In my attempt to restate the teachings of Jesus. So the teachings of Jesus are being restated anyway. We're not getting the actual verbatim words of Jesus. And we need to sound like a jerk or patronize readers, but we need to get out of that naivete that we're getting the actual words of Jesus in every case, because in a lot of cases we're not.
Yeah, but this is just part of the growing, evolving situation, understanding experience with the Urantia book. It's perfectly normal, perfectly understandable, you know, in the same way that the ideas of biblical creationism, right, had to give way to ideas that were more inclusive, right, closer to the understanding of cosmic unity. And doing that, nothing was lost. Everything was gained in that process.
So what was
point.
What's the
same thing will happen with the Urantia book. Ideas which are initial ideas that are based on something less than a full or a fuller acquaintance of the material will have to give way to better ideas, and nothing will be lost. There will be only gain in the process.
So it's going back to the Rodin paper. What was going on there? Basically, the Rodin, the place where Rodin of Alexandria supposedly does a discourse, that most of that, what you're saying, is taken from Henry Wyman.
That is simply the fact of the matter, that the paper 160, Rodin of Alexandria, is drawn almost entirely from a single book of Henry Wyman's entitled The Issues of Life. That's simply the fact of the matter, right? I'm just dealing with the fact.
Yeah. And what about
the nature of it, if you want more facts, is that it is chapter by chapter. That is, section one is chapter one. Section one of the paper is chapter one of the book. Section two is chapter two. Section three is chapter three. So that if you wanted to see the correlations for section four, you don't need to go through the whole book. Just turn to chapter four of the book. The correlations begin right there.
Okay. So what about the next paper, which is about Rodin's talk with the apostles about God and the Trinity? Is that part sourced to our knowledge?
Some of it is and some isn't. Some is and some isn't.
Now, the parts of that...
Wyman, this is probably beyond the limits of this call, but just briefly, I'll say Wyman did not believe that God was a person, right? Paper 161 takes up that question, the personality of God. Right. In other words, paper 160 doesn't take up the question specifically. It can't, because Wyman didn't accept God as a person.
Mm-hmm.
So paper 161 continues that inquiry. And it uses some of issues of life, but it also uses other material.
I wonder, you know, I'm sorry to monopolize here. There's so many questions here that I want to ask.
Yeah.
I wonder, in paper 160, does it begin, I don't have that paper in front of me, but when Rodin begins his discourse,
yeah.
Do the revelators say, do they say that usual thing in modern phraseology and in Southern?
Yes.
Oh, they do?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in that case, that's already a hint that they're using a human source.
Oh, yeah.
They're not hiding that again.
No, this, you know, I would say over and over again, no attempt has been made to hide anything in the Urantia book.
Yeah. Paula, go ahead. I'm sorry. I've been dominating the whole show here.
Well, no, and obviously we're running out of time. We have 3 minutes, and there's so many questions that come up. Somebody on the board asks if you've ever read Gary Dorian's The Making of an American Liberal Theology?
No.
No.
Is that,
okay.
Is that a book they would recommend as a kind of a great book of modern times?
So. I guess that's they're just curious if you had ever read that one.
I haven't, but I'll make a note of it.
Yeah, The Making of an American Liberal Theology.
Okay.
Gary Dorian. So we're getting down to 2 minutes now, you guys, and this is obviously the blog board has been going crazy.
I sure would like to see others take an interest in this subject and. Do some reading of source materials and get some sense of what's involved here when we talk about this subject. There's very few people have really taken an interest in it. Very, very few, surprisingly few. So, you know, with that kind of a situation, you kind of have to rely on the opinions of the few people that have, and that's not enough. We need a wider variety of response. The problem is, it's not easy to do this. It takes a lot of time. It can be a very tedious process. So, you know, there's a substantial time commitment involved. And if you don't have the time, I guess you can't do it. And there may also be an issue of preparation. I mean, in the same sense that not everybody is capable of solving differential equations. Not everybody may be prepared to do this sort of work. It's simply, you know, not their thing. But where people can do it, I sure, you know, would recommend that some do it and express their conclusions.
Right.
And
makes it different from any of the conclusions so far expressed.
And I think the beauty of all of this for me is the fact that not only is this book existent, this Urantia book that has the beautiful synthesis of so many fine, extraordinary concepts and truths, but now there's this possibility that you can expand even farther on these concepts by going to a source author and reading everything he had to say about that. And I think that's fabulous.
That's correct. I can guarantee you'll understand certain passages of the book much better, and even for the first time,
right?
Once you compare them with the source material.
We're going to have to close
even
on that note,
first,
unfortunately, we're going to have to close on that note. Steve, thank you so much for
sure.
being with us. It's been an absolute delight, and the reason I dominated this show is because it's a subject I'm absolutely passionate about, so I hope that listeners can understand that. Steve, it's great to have you on. We hope to have you on again in the future, and again, keep up the good work, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Thanks, Andre. Thanks,
all right.
Paula.
God,
have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You too.